From the Moon Broadcast Center, it's Film Week. Good morning. I'm John Horn in for Larry Mantle. This week, our critics will review Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. It's a horror film based on the popular book series, The Family Adventure, Dora and the Lost City of Gold, plus an interview with the director Tom Shadyac about his new movie, Brian Bangs. And we'll talk to Brian himself about the movie made on his own life. It's all ahead on Film Week right here on 89.3 KPCC. It's Film Week. I'm John Horn sitting in for Larry Mantle today. Coming up later on today's show, we'll hear from director Tom Shadyac, whose new film, Brian Bangs, tells the true story of a high school football star whose NFL dreams were derailed by a false rape allegation. We'll also talk to the man himself, Brian Bangs, about watching his life story be made into a movie. But first, joining us to review this week's new releases are Christy Lemire, film critic for KPCC, RogerEbert.com, and host of the Breakfast All Day podcast, and Tim Cogshell, critic for KPCC, Alt Film Guide, and Synagogues.com. Tim and Christy, welcome.
Hi, good to see you.
Sir.
So let's start with Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. It's a horror film directed by Andre Overdahl, co-written by the brothers Dan and Kevin Hageman, and Academy Award-winning filmmaker Guillermo del Toro. Christy, why don't you get us going?
And Guillermo del Toro is a producer on this, too. And I think if your kids know some of the stuff he does on television, like Troll Hunters and like Three Below, this is a good entryway into horror for them. If they know that brand, this is a good place to really start. It's based on a series of books about some kids who find this haunted mansion, this you know, legendary haunted mansion in their small idyllic town in Pennsylvania. And on Halloween, of course, of all night, they dare to break in and sneak around, and they find this hidden passageway to the basement where the legendarily the daughter of the family had been trapped and she's cursed, and any bad thing that happens has been blamed on this young woman. And they find a book and they take the book, and then stories keep getting written in the book magically on their own. And each story is about somebody in this group. And it's legitimately terrifying at times. It's very tense at times. I mean, it's a little sluggish here and there. Not all of the stories work as well as others. It does have a bit of an episodic structure in that regard. But Zoe Colletti, the young lady who is the lead of this, who finds the book and is fascinated by, you know, gothic horror and the occult, she is great. And, there's a real Stranger Things vibe here, too, with kids, you know, in adventures, on the run, getting in over their heads. And it's a lot of fun. I brought my son, and his face was like buried in my shoulder half the time.
Yeah.
He might still be
just
mad
traumatized.
At me.
Yeah.
Interesting. About nine or so, something like that.
He's nine and a half.
Or something like that. And oddly, also a serviceable film for the older horror film goer, too. So, you know, I'm not.
Like
nine,
us.
I'm not nine and a half. And yeah, serviceable because it had this sort of throwback feel to it. It's set in the 50s. And it has all those sort of 50s. These horror movie tropes, you know, the actual scare trope and all that kind of stuff. You know, it's a throwback to all of that stuff. Interestingly, the young male protagonist is a Mexican-American, and some of the issues around that are insinuated into the film. I thought that was pretty sharp on the part of Guillermo. Between him and Andre, I suppose it's an amalgamation of their styles, of what they do. So when we get to the creature effects, that's Guillermo's stuff, that thing running around with his body parts falling all off. That's what Guillermo does. The sort of jump scares and stuff like that. Well, that's what Andre does.
We're talking about Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. It's co-written by Guillermo del Toro and the brothers Kevin and Dan Hageman. It's rated PG-13 and it's in wide release. Another movie about kids, maybe not quite as terrifying, Dora and the Lost City of Gold. It's a family adventure based on Nickelodeon's TV series Dora the Explorer. Isabella Moner stars as the title character, along with Eugenio Derbez, Michael Pena, Eva Longoria, and Danny Trejo. James Bobin directs the film. Tim, why don't you get us going?
Well, you know, this is a lot of fun. So Dora, the animated series, began in 2000. In the year 2000, still running to this day, the young woman who's the star of this film was born in 2001. So the cartoon is actually older than her. She played this character before. She's just fantastic. She's just wonderful in every possible way. Off-Broadway kid. Been in a, just look at her IMDb. It's like ridiculous. As though she's been working since she's 2 or 3 years old. She can sing. She can dance. She can act. She's just wonderful. And she can look in that camera and do those goofy things that Dora does when she looks in the camera right at the audience and says, can you say, like, and you just, you cannot help but just crack up and fall to pieces as she plays this naive character, Dora, who was raised in the jungle with her little blue monkey and all of that stuff. Now, you know, narratively, this thing jumps around like it has epilepsy. You're watching this movie and you're like, and then suddenly you're like, wait a minute, what, we're just in the jungle? Now we're in this, what's going on in this movie? I think that has something to do with the actual audience of the film.
I don't know that we can make seizure jokes, but you've done it.
We just did. So what Isabella Moner is doing here is so remarkable. It's reminiscent of Amy Adams in Enchanted, in that she is totally delightful. She is guileless. She's innocent. And yet she's writing that fine line of letting you know that she is in on the joke. James Bobin and Nicholas Stoller co-wrote this. They also did the most recent couple of Muppets movies. Nicholas Stoller also wrote Get Him to the Greek and Forgetting Sarah Marshall. So the humor here is so much smarter than you might expect from a live action, full length Dora film. I mean, the idea of seeing Dora the Explorer on the big screen sounds like torture. I get that. This is so fun.
And did you wear your Dora the Explorer backpack when you went to go see it? Because my legitimate question is, does it feel like a very cynical attempt to take this character and extract more from it? Or does it feel like it could stand on its own were it not all the mythology and other things that came before?
It kind of works on both levels in that if you are a little kid seeing it, you're going to love how lively and fun it is. And she's a tremendous heroine. She's smart. She's resourceful. She's brave. She's loyal and kind. But if you're an adult, you will love the fact that they are very affectionately skewering the Dora the Explorer franchise. Like, it's not mean, but they know that you know this stuff is ridiculous and insane, and they have a really good time with that.
And Dora is kind of in on it, too. I mean, there's even a moment when she said, when, you know, he tells her something, and she says, I know, but, you know, I gotta be me. And that's, you know, that's very sharp.
And you didn't answer the question. Did you wear the Dora the Explorer backpack?
I didn't because I was afraid it was going to talk during the movie. I didn't want to disrupt my fellow patrons.
Dora and the Lost City of Gold is written by Matthew Robinson and Nick Stoller and directed by Jason Bobin. Isabella Moner stars, and the film is in wide release and rated PG. Now, The Kitchen, it's a crime drama starring Elizabeth Moss, Melissa McCarthy, Tiffany Haddish, and Donald Gleason. Andrea Berloff directed the film. It's her directorial debut, and it's based on the DC comic book series by Ollie Masters and Ming Doyle. Christy, kind words, not so kind words.
They're going to teach this film in film school someday as an example of what not to do, because this gets everything wrong on every level, every step of the way, in a way that is so shocking, given the level of talent here. I mean, beyond,
other than that, it works.
Beyond the three stars, Melissa McCarthy, Elizabeth Moss, Tiffany Haddish. Beyond them, you have this incredibly deep bench of terrific character actors. Margot Martindale, James Badge Dale, Brian D'Arcy James. It's incredible. Bill Camp. I mean, just people who are consistent. And it is edited in the most erratic, jarring way. There is no cohesion to this. But then there's nothing to these characters anyway. Elizabeth Moss's prime personality trait is that she's good at getting beaten up. And it's got kind of a rich sense of place. Hell's Kitchen in the late 70s. It's super grungy. It's, you know, grimy New York. But it all feels really superficial and rushed. And it never achieves the level of rah-rah female empowerment that it seeks.
And I would say, I've read the comic book. It is a good comic, incredibly graphically violent, but it really had a sense of style and character. And Tim, I assume that went by the wayside as well?
Well, except for the violence.
They kept that part.
They kept that part. And so in the audience that I'm watching this film with, they really enjoyed the violence.
Well, you were at the premiere, weren't you?
I was at the premiere.
Okay.
And they were hooting and hollering when the ladies got to going. Now, Elizabeth Moss' character actually has two traits. One is getting beaten up, and then her character changes completely, and then she develops that other trait, which is shooting people in the head. So it's, you know, that was kind of like, okay, you know, that's quite a character arc right there, you know, for a 90-minute movie. Look, this movie's a mess. It absolutely is a mess. The ladies are really restraining themselves, Tiffany and Melissa particularly, to not tell jokes. You can tell that they're dying to tell jokes, but you can't do that in this movie. You can't stop this movie so that you can have a moment of funny.
But if a movie like this doesn't work, even if it deserves not to work, the consequences, I think, are going to be severe. And that is that a woman can't direct a mob movie and women can't play mobsters. So if it doesn't work, it's going to be seen unfairly, probably, as a referendum on any women doing these kinds of films.
I would hope not, but it also makes Widows from last year look that much better. Widows was very good and it was overlooked, and here is, you know, it can be done and it can be done well. I will say Donald Gleason is good in this. So if you like the hot ginger, okay. Donald Gleason.
Yeah, it's interesting. We'll be talking about that documentary in a little while, Gina Davis's documentary, which, you know, speaks right to what you were just talking about there. So we shall see.
So if you want to see mob women, go check out Steve McQueen's movie, Widows. The Kitchen is written and directed by Andrea Berloff, Elizabeth Moss, Melissa McCarthy, and Tiffany Haddish star in the film. It's rated R, and it's in wide release. Now, Brian Banks, it's a biographical drama that stars Aldous Hodge, Greg Kinnear, and Tiffany DuPont. Tom Shadyac is the director. It's the first film he's directed in 10 years. More on that later. It tells the story of a high school football standout whose pro dreams are shattered after he's falsely accused of rape by a classmate. Tim, you want to start?
The true story of exactly what you just said. So this is you know, poignant in that way. So he was accused of rape by this person that completely threw his life off track. He goes away to prison for 6 years.
Let me just add here, because I know the story very well. His lawyer thought by accepting a plea deal, he might get a couple of months of probation. He had no record. He didn't have a good lawyer, obviously. He goes, enters his plea because he's afraid of a jury trial. He gets sentenced to 6 years, knowing he's innocent.
Okay, this is the thing that happens very often with young African-American and Latino men who get caught up in the system. They're encouraged to take these plea deals. And in any case, that's what happens. Now, eventually, when he gets out of prison, he gets involved in a situation where he gets a phone call from the young woman. Things happen as you might expect. Now, here's the thing. This is a perfectly serviceable movie. It's a drama. It's well acted. It's well written. It's working, generally speaking. It is unfortunate that this movie has been made and released at this particular moment in history, our Me Too sort of moment, because it goes against the idea of believing women. I can see how some folks are going to use this movie like a baseball bat against the Me Too movement.
It's problematic. It's very tricky, and it's hard not to watch this through that prism. And yeah, and the things that she does, her motivations are everything, every rape myth and misconception. It's like she's lying to protect herself. She's trying to get a big payday. You know, she's trying to turn a situation around to somebody else because of hurt feelings.
Mm-hmm.
So everything that women get accused of when they, you know, make sexual assault allegations, it all happened here. It's really unfortunate, but it's very well. Aldous Hodge is terrific in this. So natural, so charismatic, has tremendous chemistry with Greg Kinnear as the California Innocence Project lawyer who he works with. Everyone's good in this. It's a solidly made film.
You know what the problem is? You know how easy the fix is in this movie? The fix is you don't put her in the movie. You do
the
not.
Accuser.
You just don't put the accuser in the movie at all.
No, I understand what you're saying. The problem is, of course, it's a true story, and she did make it up. Brian Banks is the film from director Tom Shadyac. It stars Aldous Hodge and Greg Kinnear. It's rated PG-13. It's in wide release, and you want to stick around because later in the show, we'll talk with Tom Shadyac about leaving filmmaking for a decade, as well as play some of my interview with the real Brian Banks on the set of the film, talking about seeing his life made into a feature. Next up, Art of Racing in the Rain. It's a comedic drama starring Kevin Costner, Milo Ventimiglia, and Amanda Seyfried. Simon Curtis directs the film, and Mark Bombeck wrote the screenplay, which is based on the novel by Garth Stein. Christy.
This is definitely based on a novel, and you can tell that based on the wall-to-wall narration we get from Kevin Costner as the dog Enzo, who is, you know, incredibly wise and philosophical. And I feel like this device probably works a lot better on the page than hearing Kevin Costner's avuncular grumble, you know, to the ears. He is a dog who belongs to Milo Ventimiglia, who is this up-and-coming race car driver. Milo and Amanda Seyfried fall in love, and they get married, and they have a baby, and the dog witnesses all of this. And it is so mawkish. It is just smothered in cloying anthropomorphism from start to finish. I brought my kid to this one, too. It's been a big week for my son.
You didn't bring your dogs?
There were dogs at one of the screenings, but not at this one that I went to. I thought, okay, cool. It's a talking dog movie. You're going to love it. And he's not. It's just it's so much hand-holding, so much spelling out of everything to feel it every moment. You know the second that Amanda Seyfried has a headache and starts coughing, you know what's going to happen. It's just, and her parents are super judgy. Everyone's very two-dimensional. Again, this is probably a very rich and inspirational experience in book form, but as a film, it is really tough to sit through.
The Art of Racing in the Rain is in wide release this week. Kevin Costner, Milo Ventimiglia, and Amanda Seyfried star in the film, directed by Simon Curtis. It's rated PG. Coming up, more reviews are just ahead on Film Week. When we return, we'll talk about the documentary This Changes Everything, which looks at gender disparity in Hollywood and the Peanut Butter Falcon. It's John Horn here in for Larry Mantle today on Film Week. Back with more in just a minute. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm John Horn in today for Larry Mantle. We're joined by our Film Week critics, Tim Cogshell of Alt Film Guide and Cinegods.com, and Christy Lemire of RogerEbert.com and host of the Breakfast All Day podcast. Let's move on to This Changes Everything. It's a documentary that looks at gender disparity in Hollywood. It's directed by Tom Donahue and features firsthand stories told by some of the biggest names in Hollywood, including Gina Davis, Meryl Streep, and Natalie Portman. Tim, why don't you start us on This Changes Everything?
Well, you know, to say that this is a very important thing might sound a little bit backhanded, but it really is a very important film. It's about this. It's about women on screen, actual screen time, how much time they are on screens, our screens, as compared to men. It's about women, what women are asked to do when they're on screen, everything from what they're asked to wear to what they're asked to say. It's about women behind the camera and how there aren't women in all of those powerful positions behind the camera. It's about women in the executive suites who, by the way, get to decide about all of those other things I just mentioned and how they're not there either. And obviously, these positions are not being held by women in percentages that make any sense in juxtaposition to how many women there are in the country. What's funny about this film is that everything that's said in this film regarding women in all of those circumstances can be applied to black people, in Latino people, in Asian people. You can swap, but for the numbers here or there, you can swap it all out. Now, what does this mean about Hollywood? Hollywood, the power structure, is literally discriminating against everyone all the time, every day, except for white men of a certain age.
And straight white men.
Straight white men. And now, there are a few brave studio executives that are in this, but there are many more who are not. They don't show up. They should have named names. They should have named the names of the studio executives that they invited to be in this film who did not come.
No, they asked, and I talked to Gina about this, and none of them would come on camera. Got something to hide.
This is, of course, it's an important topic, and it's a very timely topic, and it's a mind-boggling array of A-listers who are, you know, talking about this. Besides the ones that we mentioned, also Jessica Chastain, Rashida Jones, Taraji P. Henson. She and Cate Blanchett have a great anecdote about how they will take the, you know, flimsily written girlfriend role and punch it up and make it much more interesting than it actually is on the page. A lot of great anecdotes here, but it almost tries to get its arms around too much because it's also about various lawsuits. It's also about something I had no idea about, how much more powerful women were in the silent era. And the fact that when the talkies came along, that changed the financing at the studios and put the banks in charge. And then the studio heads, who were all straight white men, wanted to please the banks. And that's why you had that going on for decades. That's a fascinating bit here. It tries to do a lot, and it's really interesting. And then the credits roll.
Yeah.
And the first thing you see is directed by Tom Donahue.
I will explain that because I asked Gina Davis this. He was working on the film before she got involved as an executive producer and as somebody who's interviewed. It was well on its way down the road, and she's like, this is going to get made. This guy knows what he's talking about. She didn't hire him. It was his project, so he is an ally, even if It's a documentary directed by a man. And the one thing I will add, my favorite anecdote, Natalie Portman talks about all the movies that she's been in. She's been directed by a woman twice, and one of those times was herself.
That's crazy.
This Changes Everything is the documentary from director Tom Donahue. It's unrated. You can see it at the Arena Cine Lounge Sunset and Lemley's Monica Film Center in Santa Monica. Now, the Peanut Butter Falcon, it comes to us from first-time directors Tyler Nielsen and Michael Schwartz. Shia LaBeouf and Dakota Johnson star along with Zach Gottsagen, who makes his feature acting debut as the lead here. Christy.
This movie is shockingly great. And on paper, it
shockingly great.
Yeah, because on paper, it sounds really mawkish. And it could have been really twee and adorable. And there's this fascinating combination of gritty realism with like a heightened kind of fairy tale romanticism going on here at once. It reminded me a bit of Beasts of the Southern Wild. Not that extreme aesthetically, but that same kind of idea. It's about this really unlikely friendship between this 22-year-old man named Zach, played by Zach Gottsagen, who has Down syndrome. And he escapes from the home where he is living because he has these dreams of being a wrestler. And along the way, he meets up with Shia LaBeouf, who is this outlaw crab fisherman who's on the run from all the people he has wronged, including John Hawks. It's this incredible supporting cast. And the two of them become friends. And then Dakota Johnson, who works at the home, finds them and becomes like this kind of makeshift family with them. It is lovely and funny and never condescending for a second. And that's what I loved about it. They all have great chemistry with each other.
And Tim, I want to pick up on something you mentioned about the Gina Davis documentary, and that is people with disabilities who often are not either cast or they're played by able-bodied actors. So how important is it that Zach Gottsagen, who has Down syndrome, plays himself?
Very, very important. And let me, I think it was Corky on a television series called Life Goes On. Was that the name of that series? And I think he's the last person I can remember who actually had, you know, whatever, and played themselves in the thing. And that's in the 80s, if I'm not mistaken, maybe the 90s.
It was a long time ago. So,
but Zach is very, very good. He's very knowing. He's very aware. He's not parodying or anything like that. He's engaged in these dramatic and comedic moments. And man, he has timing.
He has great timing.
He can deliver a line. Shia. Yeah, I've been saying on this show for years. I know Shia, he comes with baggage. Shia LaBeouf can act. Shia LaBeouf can act. And let me point out that he's one of the few, you know, movie stars who plays characters.
Right.
He's playing Huck Finn in this. This is Huck Finn and Tom Sawyer.
Mm-hmm.
But what's funny is he's playing Huck. And the other kid's playing Tom Sawyer. And Becky goes for a ride down the raft. And so this is really intriguing. So everyone is just doing really, really good work here, and I thoroughly enjoy it.
This is the best work Shia has done in a little while. Mm. Yeah,
wow.
It's great.
Peanut Butter Falcon is the film featuring the acting debut of Zach Gottsagen. He stars alongside Shia LaBeouf and Dakota Johnson. Tyler Nielsen and Michael Schwartz wrote and directed the film. It's rated PG-13. It's playing at the Landmark Theater in West L.A., the Arclight Hollywood, the Regal Edwards West Park in Irvine, and Regency Theater's Director's Cut Cinema in Laguna Niguel. Now, One Child Nation. It's a documentary from Amazon Studios about China's one-child policy. Nanfu Wang and Jiling Zhang co-directed the film. It won the U.S. Grand Jury Prize for Documentaries at this year's Sundance Film Festival. This is another movie that you all are discussing that I have seen. Difficult to watch, but really important, Tim.
I thought that I knew something about that policy. More or less went into effect in about 1979, about 40 years ago, when I was graduating from high school. It was a big news story here in the United States. We sort of used government American propaganda to beat up China about that one-child policy. It's stated at the beginning of this film that the Chinese government feels that the one-child policy was effective and correct. And in some ways, they were right. China would certainly not be the economic powerhouse that it is today with, you know, relative prosperity had they kept having children at the rate that they were having children now.
Because there might have been a horrible famine.
Almost more than likely. It's just math. You know, at the end of the day, that's just math. All right. Now, what I thought I knew about this, I knew nothing about this. We think that it was just a matter of everybody just have one child and that'll be. No. It's about the things that they engaged in and did to mostly make sure that only one child was born. And then it's about the thing that happened to the female children because they favored the boys. And difficult, man, you're not kidding.
It's stunning. It's sickening. It's heartbreaking. And Nanfu Wang grew up in China and comes back with her own child, who is a boy. And being a mother makes her consider all of this through a totally different prism. It's this heart-wrenching expose for a long time, and then it becomes a thriller when it goes into the whole adoption process and what white American parents think they are getting themselves into when they adopt a baby from China, and a discovery of what the truth behind those stories often actually is. This is tough to watch, but necessary.
Yeah, and there's also an interview with a midwife who has performed, by her counts, tens of thousands of forced sterilizations and abortions, very late term, where fetuses are delivered live and she has to kill them. And she has this, you know, moment where she figures she's going to atone for her sins and becomes an advocate for people with infertility. So it's really interesting how this story has changed, even if the policy has gone away. One Child Nation is co-directed by Nanfu Wang and Jialing Zhang. The film is rated R. You can see it at Lemley's Royal Theater in West L.A. And if you're interested in learning more about the film and director Nanfu Wang, I interviewed her earlier this week on The Frame. You could find that interview linked on the Film Week page at kpcc.org. Next up, After the Wedding, it's a drama starring Michelle Williams and Julianne Moore. Bart Freundlich is the director of the film. It's a remake of a 2006 Danish film of the same name. Christy.
Yeah, this is a Susanne Bier film, and they have remade it, but switched the gender of the characters as far as who makes discoveries about whom. But it's a tremendous cast, and that would seem to be reason for hope, and yet it is just this very restrained and tasteful melodrama. So Michelle Williams plays a young woman who works at an orphanage in India. She gets this call that a ton of money could come her way to help support these kids from a donor in New York, but she has to fly to New York City to meet this person. That person is Julianne Moore. She's this media titan, and she's married to Billy Crudup, and their daughter is about to get married that weekend that Michelle Williams is in town. So Julianne Moore invites her to their palatial home and says, come on, we'll get to know each other better. Come to the house, come to the wedding. And Michelle Williams does and makes a discovery. And they all make a discovery.
That involves Billy Crudup.
That changes everyone's lives forever. And it's a lot of like really good looking, wealthy white people being sad in beautifully decorated rooms. It's a lot of that.
I will say, though, and Michelle Williams can be so good in even mediocre movies, and I think she is just amazing in this film. It's a tough part to play, given how much is not written and what she has to do with the part, but I thought Michelle was very good in it. It opened the Sundance Film Festival earlier this year, but outside of Michelle, not a lot to recommend.
She's incredibly subtle. She really is. And no one cries like Julianne Moore, and she gets to cry big here. Mm. And there are some subtle images and moments that stuck out for me, like Michelle Williams taking off her shoes to run down a flight of stairs in this high rise because she's accustomed to walking around barefoot around the orphanage. Things like that, of her feeling stuck between two cultures. You really feel that push pull of doing the right thing, but also being tied to this history. It's okay.
It
should be better. Given who all is in it, though, you'd have reason to have high expectations.
Yeah. We're talking about After the Wedding. It's from writer-director Bart Freundlich. It stars Michelle Williams and Julianne Moore. It's rated PG-13, and you can see it at the Landmark Theater in West L.A. Ode to Joy. Mm. It's a romantic comedy starring Martin Freeman and Marina Bakarin. Jason Winter directed the film, and Max Warner adapted the screenplay from a true story by Chris Higgins from This American Life. Tim.
Yeah. You know, this movie's quirky. It's quirky. It's full of quirky people. Look, I hate quirky people in movies.
Do you hate them in real life, too?
No, I'm quirky in real life. That's perfectly good. No, in movies. And generally speaking, if you're going to have a quirky, you get one quirky person per movie. Everybody in this movie is quirky. The guy who has Martin Freeman's character, he has this disease. And it's a real disease. I looked it up. And if you get hit by these emotions, you're paralyzed and faint, right? And it's based on a true story. The guy really had this disease. So therefore, he avoided relationships and babies and cute puppies and all that kind of stuff because he was fainting all over the place. This beautiful woman comes into his life. He falls in love with her, but he can't be with her because he knows it's just going to be a mess. And we go through all this stuff. Now, here's the thing. As much as I'm sounding like I hate this movie, I like this movie. This movie is so charming. It's so smart and funny. Martin Freeman can deliver any line of dialogue at all. And you just giggle. You can't help yourself. And she is incredibly beautiful and so funny. And so, you know, it got me. I don't know that this American Life story, but this movie full of quirky people ultimately got me.
And you didn't feel like fainting.
No.
Coming up, we're talking about Ode to Joy. It's a romantic comedy starring Martin Freeman and Marina Baccarin. Jason Winter directed the film. It's rated R and playing at Lemley's Monica Film Center in Santa Monica. Coming up on Film Week, we'll dig deeper into the making of the film Brian Banks. It's out in wide release this week. We'll talk with Brian himself about the movie based on his own life story. We're also going to hear from director Tom Shadyac on why Brian's story spoke to him. I'm John Horn in for Larry Mantle. We'll be back right after this. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm John Horn in for Larry Mantle today. In case you missed our review of the film earlier in the show, one of the movies that's out in wide release this week is Bleecker Street's Brian Banks. It's the story of a highly regarded high school football player whose dreams of playing in college and the pros ended after a classmate falsely accused him of rape. Rather than risk a jury trial, Banks accepted a plea deal, having been told by his lawyer he would probably get probation, but a judge sentenced him to 6 years behind bars. Banks was ultimately exonerated a decade after his arrest. While Banks landed a couple of tryouts and played in exhibition games with the NFL after his name was cleared, his dream of pro football never became a reality. Now, Brian says he's using his platform to try to help others who are wrongfully accused and convicted. When I sat down with Brian on the set of the film Brian Banks in Memphis 2 summers ago, I started by asking him about the first time that someone suggested his story could be turned into a film and how he reacted.
I think it was in an article by a writer from ESPN. And it was one of the articles. They said, this is like right out of a movie or, you know, written right out of a movie. And the next thing you know, it kind of became like a catchy thing that a lot of the reporters would say, this story is as if it was a movie. And I think maybe it was no more than a week or so after being exonerated that I began to receive requests from different producers and directors that were interested in actually making my story into a film. And in a way, not a huge way, but it was somewhat of a bidding war where when we had an opportunity to sit with different people that are huge in the industry who've made, you know, every major film that you can think of. And we met. And then eventually we had an opportunity to sit with a woman by the name of Amy Bear. And I remember that interview or that meeting took, it was probably, we sat for almost about 3 hours and we just talked and we talked and we talked. And the thing that stood out from her amongst a lot of other people was that she got it. Like she really, truly understood the story and she realized that it wasn't a football story. And she realized that it wasn't a prison story. That this was a story about someone who experienced something that was of the unexpected, something that they didn't want to experience, but they did. And it was how, and I'm, I guess I'm speaking to myself, but how this person went through such hard times, but still was able to grieve while moving forward and pursuing what they felt was the best for them in this world. But yeah, Amy Bear was the first person we met with, and she is why we are all here today.
What was it important to you in terms of the movie that any filmmaker was going to make, and why was Tom, in your first meetings with him, important? What did he say to you that made you think that he understood the story that you wanted to have told as opposed to the story that you didn't want to have told?
My mentor would always say, you have 2 eyes, 2 ears, and 1 mouth. Listen and see more than you speak. And I think what was different about Tom is that Tom listened more than he spoke when he and I had an opportunity to talk. And I think the questions that when he finally did speak, the questions that he asked were more questions about spirituality, questions about, you know, faith, questions about perseverance and what kept you going. And just the many things that I think as human beings, we are challenged with day by day is how do we grieve with things in our lives while still being able to move forward? And then to wrap it, you know, to even add to that, Tom with his own personal experiences of, you know, having a near-death accident and almost losing his life, and having that moment of self-realization that the world was so much bigger than he once perceived. I think that me and him have so much in common, obviously on two different levels, but still that experience of almost losing everything unexpectedly and having an opportunity to become a better you.
I think that's where your life and his life are most similar. And obviously what you went through is nowhere near as horrific as, well, I mean, what happened to Tom was very serious about his bike accident and having post-concussion syndrome. But I think the similarity is you both had a moment that, you know, God, somebody gave you a moment and said, you're going to have a chance to reevaluate who you are and what you can be. And both of you made decisions for the better. Both of you, through, you know, circumstances not of your own creation, had a chance to do something different and to change your life and to come out of a bad experience with a positive attitude. And that, to me, is where your lives are most similar. I wonder if you had conversations with him about that second chance and about what it meant to be able to do something different going forward.
We've had many opportunities to have that discussion. And I think, well, one thing that we both agree on, which really stuck with me and is still with me today, is, you know, it's not what you go through, but how you allow it to affect you and what you choose to do as a response moving forward. And, you know, I've always told people, and one of the first things I told Tom is, don't judge me by what I've been through. Judge me by how I dealt with it. And because therein lies true character. And I think that's where he and I think have a lot of similarities, is that he went through something that was so severe and so tragic. But it wasn't the experience. It was how he responded to it and what he chose to do as a response to it. And he's a better person today than he was before the accident. And that's a choice. And I think, you know, and this may be a little bit of trailing off, but I just feel like that's the most powerful tool that we have as human beings, is the power of choice. That if we really truly understood that we control our emotions, we are the creator of our emotions. Our emotions do not control or create us. And if we really understand that, then we also understand that we are the master of our choices, which means that we can make these choices and we can have these emotions and give emotions to things. And it's not the other way around, where emotions come first. It's what we give to experiences and give to situations. And, you know, Tom could have gone through what he went through and allowed it to make him a more stressful person, a sadder person, a why me kind of person. But he didn't. He stood up to the plate. He said, this is my life. This is my experience. Even though unwanted, it's here. So what am I going to do next? And I think that's where we both connect, is we went through things that we didn't want to go through, but it happened. And we chose to make positive decisions for ourselves that brings a lot of light and positivity to other people.
It's unimaginable to think about what you went through, but you're having to relive it, because what this movie is doing is revisiting how bad evidence was admitted, how it was used to put you behind bars, the decision that you made at the point of a gun in terms of accepting a plea. What is it like to watch your life replayed in all of the horrible things that happened to you? To me, it's a little bit like Joe Thai's been watching his ankle get broken on slow-mo. It's like, I don't want to see that. I can't go there. But you were on set watching this.
No, actually, absolutely. You know, there are parts of this film that while it's being filmed, I won't show up. I won't come onto set that day. For example, the arrest scene where, you know, I was arrested at home, and, you know, my mother, I remember my mom, you know, dropping to her knees and screaming as loud as she could and pleading to God to not let this happen, you know? And so when they recreate scenes like that, there's no way I'd be close to it. You know, I'll wait for this film to come out to have to deal with that part. But then there's a lot of other parts that, although are tough to be around, for the purpose of authenticity and, you know, truthfulness and what really happened, I feel like it's my duty to be there. Because at the end of the day, this movie is not only just for me or the California Innocence Project, but the many other people who have experienced wrongful accusation, wrongful conviction, or may experience it somewhere near in the future. And so I would like for this film to be as accurate as possible for those who understand what this life is about. They can sit there and watch this film and go, yeah, that's how it really goes down. You know, and then it also gives people who have never experienced it or know nothing about this world to get a true and accurate a POV of this is what it is to be wrongfully convicted. This is what it is to be picked up off the street for something you didn't do. And by the time that they figured out that they made a mistake, 10 years of your life have passed. And, you know, it's hard to describe. But I think this film will give people a better insight into it.
Brian, thanks a lot.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
That was my interview with former high school football standout Brian Banks, who's the subject of a new film that carries his name. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. And coming up, I'll play you some of my interview with director Tom Shadyac, where we talk about the making of the film and how Tom and Brian's very different life stories share an important common thread. We're back in a minute. Welcome back to Film Week. I'm John Horn, hosting for Larry Mantle today. We're talking about the new film, Brian Banks, which is in wide release starting this weekend. It tells the story of a standout athlete from Long Beach who saw his football dreams destroyed when he was accused and convicted of raping a high school classmate. It's a crime he did not commit. It cost him a college scholarship, his chance at playing pro football, and 6 years of his life behind bars. The film is directed by Tom Shadyac, whom you may know as the director of comedy films like Liar Liar, Bruce Almighty, and Ace Ventura, Pet Detective. In 2007, a mountain biking accident left Shadyac with post-concussion syndrome symptoms that were so severe he felt his life might be ending. He had an epiphany, sold everything he owned, and moved to Memphis, and he went off the grid for a decade while still trying to get work in film. Finally, in 2017, Shadyac was approached about directing the Brian Banks movie. When I sat down with Shadyac on the set of the film in Memphis, I asked him what it was like to get back behind a camera after 10 years.
It all came rushing back in an instant. The only thing was a little bit of screen direction, you know, looking right, entering left, going, et cetera. But no, it all came back, including how hard it is. It's so doggone hard. But yeah, I feel like I'm home again.
I want to ask about teachable moments, because you started today's shooting by talking to the extras, and you didn't just say, here's what this scene's about, here's what you need to do. You really talked about the importance of Brian Banks's life and the importance of his story and what they, as extras in this scene, could take away from this day of work.
First of all, I don't call them extras, and I hope in our business we can move beyond that. An extra is something you have, something you don't need. I have two glasses of water. There's one extra. These guys are essentials. I call them essentials or background actors. But yeah, to me, it's one idea. If you want someone, I don't view art in a compartment. Like, we don't just make movies about justice if we're unjust to people as we make movies. So I think everything has a holistic idea to me, and I want people in that room to understand Brian's story so they can roll forward the energy that is Brian, their desire to create a more just world. That room could be as important as any room that ever sees the movie.
Why was this the movie that you had to make at this time? How did this movie speak to you, and why was it something that you felt compelled to direct?
Well, because I'd experienced it. I think, and you said earlier that I had left show business for 10 years. Now, I got hurt a few years ago. You can see that documented in the film I made called I Am. And that pulled me away for a couple of years. But I've been trying to get a gig for about 10 years. And everybody said, thank you. And then there's this rumor that I retired, and it's not true. So being a creative person who wants to stay involved and active, I started teaching, and I've been teaching for 11 years. And that drew me to Memphis because I have family here. We helped to found St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. And I taught here, and I experienced the themes of these movies through the lives of my students. I saw kids arrested for being black. I saw the injustice that Brian experienced on maybe a more intense scale happen to my students, thrown in jail for crimes they didn't commit with no evidence and no resources to get the legal help that they needed to argue their case, to prove their innocence. And I could feel it in my heart. And when I read Brian's story, and as much or more when I met him, because Brian is the right microphone for this ideology. He went through an extraordinarily difficult shadow, but came out beaming like the sun. And I met him and knew that it was something that I wanted to be a part of, to try to bring this story to the world as emblematic of a larger issue in this country.
There are things that are parallel in my mind between what you went through, what Brian Banks went through, and I'm not going to compare them, but both of you had horrific things happen to you that were none of your own doings. Brian was unjustly accused of a crime he didn't commit and served multiple years in jail for that crime. You had a bike accident and suffered post-concussion syndrome. But both of you had what I will call an epiphany. You had a moment where you were able to kind of step outside of your lives and look at your lives in a new and different way and come out the other side with new direction, new focus, new perspective. Do you think that your lives, even though they're not identical, have some sort of mirrors in them, and that what happened to Brian spoke to you on a level beyond just filmmaker who sees a good story, that there was some connection beyond that?
Yes, I think there's a good, and I'm not likening what I've gone through to the deep pain that Brian's gone through, but yes, there's an absolute parallel, and not just with me and Brian, but you and Brian and everyone and Brian. It is the hero's journey. We face obstacles. Brian's was an intense obstacle of losing 5-10 years of his life, a chance to play professional football, a chance to earn a living and help his mother, who had been working so hard for years. And he turned that darkness when he was unjustly accused of a crime, and he's turned it into light. He is literally the lump of coal that has been crushed into a diamond. And that's the opportunity that we all have. I had a concussion, and I faced my own death. And it helped me, as I reinvented myself, to drop fear in a more powerful way. The fear that said, these ideas that you've had, don't talk about them. That's why I made the movie I Am. This sense, this urgency that you have to make a difference, just push that aside and go out and make another comedy, which is important. It's important that the world laugh, and I value that. I think it's a sacred art. But there is more articulation to my spirit that wanted to happen. Again, I think it's a story we all share, and I hope when people see this movie that it's certainly not a prison movie. It's a movie about what you do when the worst thing happens to you. And we're hoping that people will see Brian's story and say, you know what, if he can survive that and even thrive through that, then I can make it through my difficulty as well.
Why do you think people didn't want to hire you? When you say you've been looking for a gig and you couldn't get one, what did you hear? What did people tell you why they didn't want to put you on a movie or a TV show?
Well, they said no. They said, you know, I can't tell you how many jobs that I applied for where they just didn't hire me. So you'll have to ask them. I mean, a lot of friends said that's impossible. Your track record is pretty impeccable, and I have a strong track record. I've been blessed with a lot of what you'd call commercial success. I mean, on a subconscious level, I think in some ways maybe it's, nobody's conscious about this, but subconsciously maybe I felt like I got sober and nobody wants the sober person in the opium den, you know? And so I sort of knew the day that I stopped flying privately because I didn't need to. Some celebrities do. It's I understand that, you know? I didn't need to, and there's a lot of resources that I could go ahead and give to people who needed them more. I sort of knew that day that I had left, you know, I had left the private club, and it was a matter of time before the private club didn't want me back in.
Because why? You were repudiating what they believed in. You were a traitor to the cause. I mean, again, imagining what it is that they imagined you had done. What was your betrayal?
Well, you have to ask people their own individual stories, and I don't want to I love everybody in show business. I'm as imperfect as anybody in show business, but you know, we're all mirrors for each other, right? And maybe, you know, having me around wasn't the thing that they wanted to look at.
Tom Shadyac, great to see you.
Thank you, brother.
That was my interview with director Tom Shadyac on the set of his film, Brian Banks. It's in wide release this weekend. And that'll do it for this week's edition of Film Week. You can listen to us live every Friday at 11, again on Saturdays at noon, and anytime via the Film Week podcast, which you can find wherever you like to get podcasts. I'm John Horn, in for Larry Mantle. Have a great weekend.